All right, good morning, everyone. It's great to see so many familiar faces in the audience today. My name is Julie McCarty, and I'm a Knowledge Management Specialist with the USAID Bureau for Food Security. And I'm very happy to welcome you to today's seminar, which has a bit of a tongue twister title, Realizing Rural Resilience and Inclusive Growth by Reducing Risk. Is Agricultural Insurance the Key? This seminar is actually a special joint presentation in both the MicroLinks seminar series and the AgriLinks Ag Sector Council seminar series. And if you're not aware, MicroLinks and AgriLinks are sister sites, sister knowledge management platforms, and they're both managed by the Feed the Future Knowledge-Driven Agricultural Development Project, who is also managing the webinar part of the seminar today. And so whether you discovered this seminar through MicroLinks or AgriLinks, I highly encourage you to sign up to receive updates via the other site. Whether your wheelhouse is food security and ag or inclusive market systems, there's a lot of content on both sites that's very of mutual interest to both sectors. And so that's part of why we wanted to have a joint seminar today. We thought this fit both very well into both of the seminar series, and also to just help bring our two communities together since there's so much crossover. So to move forward, I'd like to pass the microphone over to Kristen Oplanik.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for joining us this morning for those of you here in D.C. and whatever time of day it is for those of you online. I know we have over 100 people joining us from around the world, so welcome to our virtual participants as well. I'm also excited for this joint seminar. So often when we think about our programming to promote agricultural market systems, we default to that good old profit incentive. But more and more, we've learned on the ground that especially for the poor, minimizing risk can be more important to upgrading for competitiveness and for the resilience of the household. So today, we're going to focus on risk management and how an integrated approach to risk management can provide a pathway out of poverty. In particular, we'll examine the role of insurance as a piece of that overall package. So our speakers today are Richard Chollerton, who is chief of the World Food Program's Climate and Disaster Risk Reduction Programs Unit. In this role, he leads WFP's engagement on climate change and disaster risk reduction. He is also responsible for developing innovative risk management solutions targeting the most vulnerable and food insecure populations. Richard is an expert on emergency preparedness, risk financing, resilience, food security, and disaster risk reduction. He also served as the Director of Humanitarian Assistance at a top 10 U.S. nonprofit and led early warning and decision support operations at the Famine Early Warning Systems Network. Lana Herron is the Senior Rural Development Advisor in the Bureau for Food Security at USAID. She has been with USAID since 2000 and has conducted numerous agricultural sector assessments and design projects to promote agricultural value chain development. She is the USAID Project Manager for the Assets and Market Access Collaborative Research Support Program, a virtual research facility which aims to improve the economic resiliency of the rural poor through policy-relevant research on access to and the function of markets. That's a handful, Lena. She also manages USAID's engagement with the World Bank on Agricultural Insurance Development Program and the National Agricultural Risk Assessment. So if you haven't already, for those of you in the room, please silence your phones, and we will hand it over to our speakers.
Many people know the World Food Program for our humanitarian work. That's the bulk of what we do. But a significant part of our work around the world is focused on helping food insecure people build resilience, reduce the risk they face so that they can become food secure, and in fact, that's our second point in our mandate and our mission around the world, and it has been for a very long time since our founding 40, 50 years ago. And of the 100 million people a year that we support, anywhere between 15 and 30 million people a year, we're helping to try and address the risks that they face to food security in 50% of our programs and in 75% of the countries that we work in. We started working on insurance mechanisms over 10 years ago. And we started doing that because we saw a potential to use an instrument that provided predictable response, particularly to droughts, when we were seeing delays in response to large-scale droughts, knowing that we needed to be able to quickly mobilize resources to support action early. That's led to a whole series of work on sovereign risk financing with governments and safety nets, but it also led to a whole series of work on agricultural micro-insurance to try and help the populations that we ended up responding to support with emergency assistance year after year, find a better way to manage the risks that they faced. After a few years of doing that, we realized a couple of things. First, we realized that our core beneficiaries can't afford insurance, and that was a problem. We realized that, you know, agricultural insurance could be done, especially weather index insurance, which is what we were really focused on at the time. You could do it. You could sell it to farmers. It could work, at least at a small scale. But our farmers couldn't afford it. So maybe it was better for someone else to do it. And we also realized that insurance by itself doesn't work. It has to be somehow connected with something else. You need a delivery channel. It needs to be part of a broader risk management package. And at a time where we were about to close down that work, we learned of a small pilot project in Ethiopia being implemented by Oxfam America called Harita, where they and their partners had been discussing with farmers, would you be able to use agricultural insurance? Here's how it works. What do you think? And a farmer in a village in Tigray, a place called Adiha, said, well, yeah, that sounds good, but I can't afford it. Can I work for it? I work in the productive safety net program of the government of Ethiopia in exchange for food and cash to help me. Can I work extra days in exchange for an insurance policy? And Oxfam and their partners, REST, had said, okay, let's try that. First year they insured 200 people, the next year 1,300 people. And we said, okay, that could be something interesting for WFP. We have 20 million people, more or less, every year in food and cash for work or food and cash for assets programs, building assets, working in exchange for food and cash. And quite often they get hit by a shock, and the gains they've made are eroded, and maybe this is a way to bring together the work on insurance and our work on risk reduction and safety nets. And that's how the R4 Rural Resilience Initiative was born, as an equal partnership between Oxfam and WFP, with the support of Swiss Re, USAID, a number of other donors, to test whether or not we could bring those things together and scale them up. And so what I want to do for the next few minutes is explain to you a little bit of what is R4 and what's the approach, how do we bring these things together, what does it look like, where we are, and then most importantly, what have we learned. We've been at this now for almost five years in a number of countries, and so I want to try and give you a sense of what we've learned. Okay, so first, I said, you know, we're bringing together a number of things, and the idea of R4 was really to bring together risk reduction and safety nets and risk transfer and credit and savings in a more comprehensive package. So rather than explaining that a lot, I'd like to just run through a quick kind of presentation of I guess our attempt to show what it looks like in real life. So, you know, most food insecure farmers, they grow one or two crops a year. They harvest. They have some food and income for a while. When their food and income runs out, they have a deficit. They reduce their food consumption. they become food insecure during the lean season, and you see seasonal food shortages. And that's a common pattern we see in many places. And safety net programs are usually designed to deal with this seasonal shortage, to help people meet their basic food needs during periods of stress predictably, so they can focus on investing in their livelihoods and maintaining their food security. In a good year, maybe they make it, but most years they don't. Now, when a shock hits, particularly a major drought, they face a much more serious problem. They have less food and income, a deeper food deficit, and that has a whole range of impacts. You pull your kids out of school, you don't repay loans, you don't invest in season inputs, you reduce consumption, and so on. And you don't recover quickly. Our research in Niger shows, for example, that the most food insecure households after a drought take 3 years to recover basic consumption and stop distress coping. So it takes some time. And with increasing climate risks, especially from climate change and environmental degradation and other things, what you see is sort of a process of destitution and livelihoods decline. And in many regions of the world, particularly the Horn of Africa or the Sahel, we've seen that problem and pattern for quite a while now, and have been struggling to try and find a way to address that cycle. So R4 really is designed to help turn that downward trend into a positive one, and help people build a range of risk management capacities that help them deal with those droughts and shocks. So first and most importantly, in R4, is we really focus on helping implement good, solid disaster risk reduction activities that reduce the impact of droughts and floods. And in many of the areas we work, you see high levels of environmental degradation, so even a small amount of weather variability can translate into a significant shock for households. So things like soil and water conservation, irrigation systems, watershed management have a major impact both on reducing the impact of the shock but also in easing productivity. So if we do that, then the shock's impact is less, but there's still an impact, and that's where insurance can play a role. And so with insurance for assets or insurance for work, the households that we're working with in the safety net are given the option to work extra days on more community disaster risk reduction in exchange for a drought insurance policy which pays them if there's a drought. So if there's a drought, that can bring them at least up to the level where they can meet their needs. But that's not really good enough, because you don't want to sort of maintain people just above the line. The point of resilience is so people can build thriving livelihoods and improve their lives. And so then we really try to focus on helping people take prudent risk. And that could mean access to credit. It could mean diversifying livelihoods, especially diversifying livelihoods out of climate-sensitive sources of livelihoods, so that they're not as affected by a shock and more resilient. And also so that they can build up savings, which they can use as a buffer. Insurance is expensive. You don't want to use it all the time. Otherwise, it's prohibitively expensive. So having other mechanisms to manage smaller shocks is important. And so the kind of model for R4 is that you keep working on risk reduction, you help people build up their own reserves, you put in place insurance so they can protect investments in their livelihoods, and next time a shock occurs, it's not as bad, they have protection, and they can keep maintaining their development processes. And that's the idea that we have essentially tried to implement in R4 in four countries, different contexts, And now we have quite a lot of learning. In Ethiopia, we've been operating together with Oxfam now for 5 years. In Senegal, we've had 2 full cycles with insurance, but 3 years of programming, and we've just started in Malawi and Zambia. And what's really interesting from an insurance perspective is we've had payouts, including the largest agricultural microinsurance payout ever in Ethiopia in 2012, where we had 12,000 households out of our 20,000 households receive about $320,000. That's $25 a head. It's 25% of the annual income of a safety net beneficiary, so that's a significant, significant payout. So what are we seeing? We just completed the first impact evaluation of Ethiopia, and the results are very, very interesting. There's a significant difference between the results we see for households with insurance and households without insurance. Insured households have 123% more savings, 25% more plow oxen. They invest 25% more in agricultural labor. In one cluster of villages, they had 254% more household cereal stocks. And you're seeing particularly good impacts on women-headed households. Many report that they have stopped sharecropping out their land and are farming it themselves. You're seeing increased investment in farming. And better use of improved seeds and composting for those households. You're seeing when you talk to people that they're more willing to take risk because they feel protected. They're happy to pay insurance premiums, especially in labor, because they get something else out of it—an asset, you know, like an irrigation canal or an improved terrace. And they see that it's working. In Senegal, we're now on the third year of insurance. We're starting to scale up. And I wanted to just talk about lessons in three areas, and then I'll pass over to Lena. What are we learning on insurance? What are we learning on gender? And what are we learning on financial access? So, On insurance, we're learning that it's hard. Insurance is a hard business, especially in the places where we're talking about. And one of the hardest things is to really help foster a sustainable market where local insurers are willing to develop products, offer products, and really build a private sector infrastructure rather than relying on us to provide those things. And one of the key things that we're seeing in Senegal is trying to develop distribution channels for multiple products increases the interest of local insurers in the market. If they know that they can sell crop, livestock, asset, other kinds of insurance to those communities, then they see a more viable business model than just a single product in a single place. And so, for example, we have been working to link our crop insurance distribution with the sale of livestock insurance commercially to farmers in the same areas, so they have access to that as well. So helping to expand the network and crowd in more products. Especially with index insurance, both in Senegal and Ethiopia, one thing that has been really, really important is the index design process itself and a process of continuous improvement. It's not easy, but you can go to a community, you can look at crop yield data, you can look at weather data, you can come up with an index, you can write a product. But what we've tried to do is have a community-based design process where the product itself is really tailored to the specific livelihoods and cropping strategies of the farmers we're targeting. So, you know, if you plant a long cycle crop, but then there's a late start to the season, and you switch to a short cycle crop, we tried to design the product with farmers so that it covers the early window so they can replant if it fails, and cover the late window in case they have a total crop failure. So you can integrate the product into their actual farming practices. But even when you do that, every year it's important to go back and validate. Did it work? How do you adjust it? To keep fine-tuning it, because there's lots of room for error in there, and we just don't know yet how to get it right the first time. I'm not sure if we will. Delivery channels are key. This is a common thing we keep saying over and over again in our discussions about insurance. You can have the product, but if you don't have a way to get it to people, you don't have a sustainable delivery channel, that's a major constraint. So in Ethiopia, we've used the Productive Safety Net program as the distribution channel. So you have a large infrastructure in place, it's regular, it's sustained, helps you with targeting, distribution of payouts, collection of premiums, and so on. In Senegal, we've used WFP's program in country, but that's not quite as stable. And at some point, we hope that that's replaced by a government productive safety net, and the government of Senegal is focused on that at the moment. But it's not there yet. So that's how we think about building the distribution channels and integrating is really important. We're also finding that farmers understand the importance of the integrated approach, that you need risk reduction, that you need risk transfer, that you need better access to credit and inputs and so on. And so that's reassuring that we haven't just cooked up a nice diagram and tried to implement it and nobody understands it. People really, I think, seem to appreciate that. On gender, we're seeing quite a lot of interesting things on gender. We've seen increased access to land, seas, and water for irrigation and drinking. That has an impact on the amount of time, especially women and girls, spend collecting water, and that gives them more time for other things. In Senegal, we have a major component on savings groups. We have, as a core part of the program, women's and men's savings groups, and so that's resulted in better numeracy, literacy, and business skills for women. And in general, we're seeing more confidence from women on their ability to meet their basic needs, care for their children, pay school fees, and so on. In Ethiopia, one of the main things that families use payouts for is paying school fees. So that's an interesting finding as well. On financial access, our risk reserve, our savings component, and our prudent risk taking, our credit livelihoods diversification component, see a lot of demand. So we see, even though there's quite a lot of microfinance institutions operating in Senegal, we see a huge demand, especially for informal financial services. And once you have informal savings groups established, you see a lot of demand for connection to formal microfinance services. we see really the importance of good quality training so that people's financial literacy is improved. And that not only helps with the savings and credit access, it also helps with the insurance and fitting those pieces of the puzzle together. We see also the savings being used really as a vehicle for investment, for risk-taking itself, which is what we hope for. So people are using it, especially men, to buy ag inputs, and then particularly women for investment in petty trade activities. Okay, I'll stop there. There's so much more to talk about, but I hope we can get into some of the issues during questions, and I'll pass over to Lena. Thanks very much.
really nice. It was such a nice presentation. Thank you, Richard. Hello, everyone. I think we're going to do questions and discussion at the end, so I'll just go along. I'm Lena Herron from VFS, the Bureau of Food Security at USAID. When I first heard about the R4, I got into a discussion about the R4 model with people. It was like 10 years ago, I think. Huh? A few less? I've been working on this topic for about 10 to 12 years now, coming into it from an agricultural development, value chain development angle, and trying to figure out how to make finance work for ag development and work on poverty in that context. And I remember the first time I met with some of the folks on R4, and I felt like I had met my people. I felt like what they were saying about the integration of risk reduction and risk transfer along with the risk, improving people's ability to manage their own risk, to cope through savings and then prudent risk taking, it resonated with me. I realized I had been talking about that very thing. So when we, this is my objective, I should say, the portfolio that I work on in the Bureau of Food Security. I work a lot on insurance and trying to make specifically indexed insurance products available and effective instruments, tools that we can use in our agricultural development programming. Why indexed insurance particularly? I think many people have heard a lot of presentations on indexed insurance. We need lots of different kinds of insurance and other kinds of risk management tools. I work particularly on indexed insurance because it's one of the harder ones to make work because of the capacity needs in host countries. But really, we need a wide range of mechanisms. But we need them as tools for the kinds of things they can add to our programming. Specifically, we're looking at it within the Feed the Future kind of strategic framework. We're looking at it both on the what it can do for ag sector growth, but also on resilience. And I think Richard just spoke very compellingly about those kinds of things and the kinds of things they're seeing in their programming. We're looking at it in terms of what it can do to increase access to finance, what it can do in terms of increasing technology adoption, and people's just own incentive to invest in their own production. On the resilience side, again, Richard gave us some examples, and I'll give some others that we're seeing in terms of some of the work that we're doing. But looking at changing the coping strategies that people are using, and we're really seeing improvements in the types of coping strategies in terms of people consuming, not consuming less meals, right? So not using that kind of potentially very negative coping strategy of cutting back on meals. Also, the fact that you can change the response time and so that people don't deplete their assets is a really important thing, because once people deplete assets, it's very hard to climb back out. And that was, I think, I love your graphics on that. That downward spiral, it's very hard for people to climb back out of that poverty trap once they start falling in. We're also seeing shifts in people's aspirations, whether people, once you fall down into that poverty trap, not only is it hard, it's hard to climb out, it's hard to even imagine climbing out for a lot of the people that we work with. And I think that can be devastating. So shifting those aspirations. We're seeing the similar kinds of findings that the R4 people are producing. Very consistent, right? That when, on the investment side, this is on the ag growth side, that when you take some of that risk out of the system, we're also finding anywhere between 20 to 30% improvements in, say, adoption of technologies and use of improved seeds or fertilizer or labor. We're seeing that. We saw that in Mali with a project, Ghana, similar kinds of findings. In Kenya, the livestock insurance product there led to people investing more in the quality of animals within their herds, so improving veterinary services for their herds and resulting in higher incomes from milk sales. On the coping side, similar, again, these are examples of the kind of findings. I think they're very consistent with the kind of stuff they're seeing in R4, that people are 25% less likely to reduce the number of meals consumed per day in the face of a drought. 25%, that's pretty significant. And it was much higher for poorer households. 43% less likely to cut back a little bit on the food that they're eating a day. And why is that important? I mean, the people who work on humanitarian assistance know, mom and dad cutting back on a meal, that's maybe they can withstand that. Where this becomes incredibly important is for kids, right? That when kids are cutting back consistently on meals, you're basically transferring that shock into the next generation, because that has cognitive impact and other kinds of developmental impacts, right? We're also, this is the asset part of it, we're less likely to see people sell off their assets in the face of some crisis, right? So less likely to see distress sales of animals or other kinds of assets. And again, that's the poverty trap these are both kind of poverty traps that are very hard to climb back out of. So BFS has a increasingly broad portfolio to try to expand access to these kinds of tools and improve the quality of these tools. We started with mostly an R&D kind of project. It was mentioned, this collaborative research support program that I manage. I've been for almost 10, 12 years now putting, directing funds towards doing research on these kinds of activities. And that's where some of those numbers came from, different activities. We've had probably a dozen pilots and different activities in as many countries or nearly as many countries over the last dozen years. As Richard said, this is hard stuff to do. This stuff is not easy. And especially at this retail level where we're working, it's hard. And there's a need for tremendous capacity building, work on every angle. It's kind of like the early days of microfinance, right? How do you figuring out how to make it work? And we're still learning a lot. But that's what that insurance initiative, Index Insurance Initiative, is mostly an R&D effort to try to build the evidence and build the know-how and contribute. We've also started something called the Global Action Network on Index Insurance, and we pull in these folks, the academics involved in this group, but also people like the R4, private sector, multilaterals, people like the IFC, the Global Indexed Insurance Fund over at the IFC, are all part of this kind of network that we're trying to come together at that global level to figure out what are the constraints to really developing this stuff as an effective tool for development professionals and private sector to use in these developing country contexts. So that's what that one's about. I'm going to talk a few more, next couple of slides, a little bit more detail about these two things just to show you an example. But this is a scaling effort by the bank that USAID's supporting, and then an example of kind of a research-linked scaling activity that I want to talk about with the climate-resistant maize. But I want to point out, this African risk capacity as well. We're starting to engage with another part of what was originally a WFP activity, African Union now, to develop a sovereign risk management facility that uses indexed insurance. And so one of the things I want to point out about that is that, these insurance and risk management is something that operates at many levels, right? We are, R4 and a lot of the work that I'm doing with I4, which is kind of a joke among us that we have these There are many letters left with four that you could get involved with. Work on this retail level, right? Work at the kind of insurance for households, farmers, producers, and so on. But these products can be used at the meso level for portfolio, for value chain actors, financial portfolios of MFIs and banks. They are obviously can be used at the more sovereign level for sovereign risk at the macro level and so on. So, and we need to, again, develop more mechanisms and more of an understanding at the country level how to use these mechanisms. Just a little bit of detail on a couple of these activities. This is a newer activity for USAID to get involved with the World Bank as the partner on this. It's really about developing public-private partnerships at the country level where the public is not, I just realized I had gotten tethered with your tape, Adam, that the public is not donors, but the public is the country partnering with its private sector to utilize market-mediated instruments to manage risk, right? And so in some cases, it may be using insurance as part of its safety net, right, for its resilient to meet its resilience objectives. In other cases, it may be that it, instead of handing out seed and fertilizer, it backs off a little bit and maybe partially subsidizes an insurance program, which changes the risk structure that producers are facing, so that they're more likely to buy and invest in fertilizer and seed, right? So it's looking at the options for achieving both resilience and agricultural growth objectives with these more market-mediated tools. We're not doing this everywhere, right? I mean, this stuff is not ready for prime time everywhere, but in a few key countries, it's really moving forward. So in Kenya, for example, the government has put about $1.5 million this year into rolling out a livestock, both livestock and crop insurance. So that's for just this year, but they're also in negotiations to put a program together over the next 5 years to continue rolling this out. Private sector will be implementing that, right? This is a partnership between the government and the private sector. And one of the things I loved that Richard mentioned, and I want to underscore, is that there's huge complementarities between insurance where it's used, and kind of subsidized by the public sector and the development of the commercial market. There's huge complementarities there. Bangladesh is another country where this program is working. I think a statistic like that every year on average, right, that if you take all of the up years and down years, that on average this country like Bangladesh loses 2.4% of its ag GDP, I think that specifically refers to crises, right? So that means in a bad year it could be like 10%, right, or something. That's a big hit for a country to take. And so you get countries like Bangladesh, that really need to do something about that risk exposure because it's dragging them down anyway, and they're paying for it anyway, right? And I think that's where you get governments understanding that they have an incentive to figure out how to manage this risk, both at the sovereign level and have their country, the people in their country better managing that risk. So AIDP is focusing on that as well. Climate Resilient Maize is a new activity that we're putting in place, again, under this kind of R&D shop. We've mobilized some of the researchers that I work with from U.S. universities and host country institutions to partner with CIMMYT, develop these drought-resistant maize varieties. They're both working with private sector. The idea is to get these seeds out in and used in the commercial market, right? We believe that insurance will improve that uptake, Okay? And so we're building a component into this effort to really scale out the availability and uptake of those seeds. We're building in a component that will develop an insurance product that's optimized for those seeds. And what I love about that is that if you think about drought-resistant varieties of any crop, right, so maize in this case, that the drought-resistant varieties take care of, you know, the moderate drought, right? That's, I mean, the drought, the seed guys will tell you, they don't take care of the severe drought. They don't take care of the really, you know, deep hit. And so people still are hesitant to adopt them. They like the idea of having the moderate drought protection, but unless they can get the more severe protection as well, they're still hesitant to adopt those varieties because they have to take a loan for them, right? And so this activity is trying to combine the complementarity of improved seed to handle the moderate drought with an insurance product that picks up just the tail end severe drought and puts those together. It makes the seed more attractive. It makes the insurance a little bit cheaper because you don't worry about the moderate drought with the insurance. And so the whole package together is a lot more attractive to the farmers. We're doing this in Mozambique and Tanzania. We're just starting that up. So stay tuned for this because we're going to probably bring back a presentation, I don't know, next year or the year after on what happens with that. Has it worked out the way that we believe it will based on other kinds of findings? Because of all of the I4 activities are with researchers, we build really rigorous impact evaluation into this. So we'll have good solid. And I think what's interesting about the impact evaluation is it's not just on the productivity and incomes, but the kinds of stuff that R4 data was looking at as well. Women's empowerment within the household and the gendered aspects, whether it changes people's eating patterns and the fact that they're sending their kids to school and such as well. Just a few last words. I was just out in Senegal. I had the pleasure of traveling with Richard's colleagues and André Marchand from E3 to visit the R4 site and also attend a insurance day workshop that the mission hosted out there. You know, a lot of our work in Bureau of Food Security, we have our own portfolio of activities, but we're increasingly working with missions who are integrating this stuff into programming in very exciting ways. Both of the mission's activities, you know, their flagship value chain activity and their resilience, kind of more resilience-oriented activity, both of those agricultural development activities integrate insurance into their programming. They're not doing the insurance, they're tapping into insurance that is taking place within the country more broadly, but they're working to support and develop and enhance and utilize and integrate it into programming in a way that I think is really a model for other countries to look at. I was really impressed by the strength of the agricultural for development, I kind of call it, community out in Senegal, and with the government in the lead, the government has the ag insurance company out in Senegal is a co-owned government private sector partnership, and what was really interesting about this insurance day was the fact that, you know, yes, the projects that are utilizing this were there, but so were the insurance companies, both the PPP insurance company on ag insurance and the member insurance companies that are part of that, and the government. The thing was opened by the secretary director from the Minister of Ag and the mission director, so high-level interest. 60 government, private sector, NGO, and program reps were all there and very engaged, very excited to kind of identify what are the constraints to really working with this, what are the opportunities. We had a really compelling presentation by one of the very dynamic leaders of a farmers organization who talked about how important it is for her members to be able to use these tools. I think in a way that's, you know, I feel like I, I'm so passionate about this stuff, but it's so exciting for me. It's so refreshing for me to just be able to sit back and listen to somebody in the field like that talk about why this stuff matters to her, right? So very exciting there. I think that's all I had to say. Oh, no, of course not. What presentation would be complete without saying, again, this stuff is hard, and it can be done poorly. I always try to say that at these presentations. I'm such a cheerleader for insurance, and yet I am also the first person to say, oh my gosh, you can really screw this up. You really can. Right?
Yep.
Richard also made this argument for we have to pay attention to how this stuff is designed. It is our job as development professionals to make sure that the development elements of this are still maintained, right? We can't do it without the private sector, but the private sector's not the ones that are necessarily going to make sure that it has a development impact. And so making sure that the quality of the contracts that are used have a lot of client value, very important. Richard talked about these same things, outreach and education. We need informed consumers. People, this stuff is, insurance is expensive, and it's not always the best way to manage the risk. People need to understand what they're purchasing. Otherwise, it can be a disaster, right? The importance of integrating it into other distribution channels and other efforts, as I think R4 is a great example of. And then finally, and a big part of what we're working on in this AIDP is helping the public sector understand what a good role for the public sector is. Because these things this tool will not become available unless you have a concerted effort between the private sector and the public sector, I am convinced, and donors. All of us working together in a concerted way. And so it's really important that the public sector understand what the right role is. I mean, that's a familiar story, right? We in development are familiar with that's the public sector has an important role to play, but it needs to figure out what that role is, and we can help in that way. That's what I have. I think that's it. Thank you.